Chapter 10. Gardner Decides. 1. Good God. Gardner sat down heavily on a fresh stump. It felt like a case of sit down or fall down, like being punched hard in the stomach. No, it was stranger and more radical than that. It was more like someone had slammed the hose of an industrial vacuum cleaner into his mouth and turned it on, sucking all the wind out of his lungs in a second's time. Good God, he repeated in a tiny, breathless voice. It seemed to be all of which he was capable. It's something, isn't it? They were halfway down the slope, not far from where Anderson had found the dead Chuck. Before, the slope had been pretty heavily wooded. Now, a lane had been cut through the trees to admit a strange vehicle which Gardner almost recognized. It stood at the edge of Anderson's dig, and it was dwarfed both by the excavation and by the thing which was being unearthed. The trench was now 200 feet long and 20 feet wide at either end. The cut bulged to 30 feet or so in width for perhaps 40 feet of the slit's total length. That bulge made a shape like a woman's hips seen in silhouette. The gray leading edge of the ship, its curvature now triumphantly revealed, rose out of this bulge like the edge of a giant steel tea saucer. Good God, Gardner gasped again. Look at that thing. I have been, Bobby said, a distant little smile playing over her lips. For over a week I've been looking at it. It's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. And it's going to solve a lot of problems, Gard. There came a man on horseback, riding and riding. That cut through the fog. Gardner looked around at Anderson, who might have been drifting in the dark places from which that incredible thing had come. The look on her face chilled Gardner. Bobby's eyes were not just far off. They were vacant windows. What do you mean? Anderson looked around as if coming out of a deep daze. What do you mean, a man on horseback?
I mean you, Gard. I mean me. But I think I mostly mean you. Come on down here and take a look.
Anderson started down the slope quickly, with the casual grace of previous experience. She got maybe 20 feet before she realized Gardner wasn't with her. She looked back. He had gotten up from the stump, but that was all.
It won't bite you, Anderson said.
No? What will it do to me, Bobby?
Nothing. They're dead, Gard. Your Tommyknockers were real enough, but they were mortal. And this ship has been here for at least 50 million years. The glacier broke around it. It covered it, but it couldn't move it. Not even all those tons of ice could move it. So the glacier broke around it. You can look into the cut and see it, like a frozen wave. Dr. Borns from the university would go batshit over this. But they're dead enough, Gard.
Have you been inside? Gard asked, not moving.
No. The hatch, I feel there is one, is still buried. But that doesn't change what I know. They're dead, Gard. Dead.
They're dead. You haven't been in the ship, but you're inventing like Thomas Edison on a speed trip, and you can read minds. So I repeat, what's it going to do to me? So she told the biggest lie of all. Told it calmly, with no regret at all. She said,
"Nothing you don't want it to,"
and started down again, without looking back to see if he was following. Gardner hesitated, his head throbbing miserably, and then he started down after her.
2.
The vehicle by the trench was Bobby's old truck. Only before that, it had been a country squire station wagon. Anderson had driven it from New York when she came to college. That had been 13 years ago, and it had not been new then. She had run it on the road until 1984, when even Elt Barker down at the Shell station, Haven's only garage and gas stop, would no longer slap an inspection sticker on it. Then, in one weekend of frenzied work, they had been drunk for most of it, and Gardner still thought it something of a miracle that they hadn't blown themselves up with Frank Garrick's old blowtorch rig. They had cut off the roof of the wagon from above the front seat on back, turning it into a half-assed truck.
Look at that, guard, old guard, Bobby Anderson had proclaimed solemnly, staring at the remains of the wagon. We done made ourselves an honest-to-God field bomber.
Then she leaned over and threw up. Gardner had picked her up and carried her onto the porch, Peter twining anxiously about his feet the whole way. By the time he got her there, she had passed out. He put her down carefully and then passed out himself. The half-assed truck had been a tough old Detroit rod bucket, but it had finally gone toes up. Anderson had put it on blocks at one end of the garden, claiming no one would want to buy it even for parts. Gardner thought she just felt sentimental. Now the truck had been resurrected, although it hardly looked like the same vehicle, except for the blue paint and the remains of fake wood siding that had been one of the country squire's trademarks. The driver's door and most of the front end were gone entirely. The latter had been replaced with a weird conglomeration of digging and earth-moving equipment. To Gardner's disturbed eye, Anderson's truck now looked like a deranged child's bulldozer. Something which looked like a giant screwdriver blade protruded from the place where the grill had been. The engine looked like something which had been yanked whole from an old D9 Caterpillar. Bobby, where did you get that engine? How did you move it from where it was then to where it is now? Good Jesus! Yet all this, remarkable as it was, could hold his eye for only a moment or two. He walked across the ripped earth to where Bobby was standing, hands in pockets, looking into the slash in the earth. What do you think, guard? He didn't know what he thought, and was speechless anyway. The excavation went down to an amazing depth, 30 or 40 feet, he guessed. If the angle of the sun hadn't been exactly right, he wouldn't have been able to see the bottom of the trench at all. There was a space of about 3 feet between the side of the excavation and the smooth hull of the ship. That hull was utterly unbroken. There were no numbers, symbols, pictures, or hieroglyphs on it. At the bottom of the cut, the thing disappeared into the earth. Gardner shook his head, opened his mouth, found he still had no words, and shut it again. The part of the hull Anderson had first tripped over and then tried to wriggle with her hand, thinking it might be a tin can left over from a logger's weekend, was now directly in front of Gardner's nose. He could easily have reached across the 3-foot space and grasped it, as Anderson herself had just 2 weeks ago, with this difference. When Anderson first grasped the edge of the ship in the earth, she had been on her knees. Gardner was standing. He had vaguely noted the going over this slope had taken, rough, muddy terrain, trees that had been cut and moved aside, stumps that had been pulled like rotten teeth. But beyond that momentary observation, he had dismissed it. He would have taken a closer look if Anderson had told him how much of the slope she had simply cut away. The hill had made the thing harder to get out, so she had simply removed half the hillside to make it easier. Flying saucer, Gardner thought faintly, and then, I did jump. This is a death fantasy. Any second now I'll come to and find myself trying to breathe salt water. Any second now, just any old second. Except that nothing of the sort did or would happen, because all this was real. It was a flying saucer. And that, somehow, was the worst. Not a spaceship, or an alien craft, or an extraterrestrial vehicle. It was a flying saucer. They had been debunked by the Air Force, by thinking scientists, by psychologists. No self-respecting science fiction writer would put one in his story, and if he did, no self-respecting editor would touch it with a 10-foot pole. Flying saucers had gone out of vogue in the genre at roughly the same time as Edgar Rice Burroughs and Otis Adelbert Klein. It was the oldest wheeze in the book. Flying saucers were more than passé. The idea itself was a joke, given mental house room these days only by crackpots, religious eccentrics, and, of course, the tabloid newspapers, where any week's budget of news had to include at least one saucer story, such as 6-year-old pregnant by saucer alien tearful mother reveals. These stories, for some odd reason, all seem to originate in either Brazil or New Hampshire. And yet,
here was such a thing. It had been here all the while, as centuries passed above it like minutes. A line from Genesis suddenly occurred to him, making him shiver as if a cold wind had blown past. There were giants in the earth in those days. He turned toward Anderson, his eyes almost pleading. Is it real? He could no more than whisper. It's real. Touch it. She knocked on it, producing that dull fist-on-mahogany sound again. Gardner reached out, then pulled his hand back. A look of annoyance passed over Anderson's face like a shadow. I told you, guard. It won't bite you. It won't do anything to me. I don't want it to. Absolutely not. Gardner reflected, as much as he was able to reflect in his current state of roaring confusion, that he had once believed that about booze. Come to think of it, he had heard people, most of them his college students in the early 70s, say the same thing about various drugs. Many of them had ended up in clinics or drug counseling sessions with severe nose candy problems. Tell me, Bobby, did you want to work until you dropped? Did you want to lose so much weight that you looked like an anorexic? I guess all I really want to know is, did you drive or was you driven? Why did you lie about Peter? Why don't I hear birds in these woods? Go on, Anderson said patiently. We've got some talking to do and some hard decisions to make, and I don't want you breaking in halfway through to say you've decided the whole thing was just a hallucination that came out of a liquor bottle. That's a shitty thing to say. So are most of the things people really have to say. You've had the DTs before. You know it, and so do I. Yeah, but the old Bobby never would have brought it up, or at least not in that way. You touch it, you'll believe it. That's all I'm saying. You make it sound important to you. Anderson shifted her feet restlessly. All right, Gardner said. All right, Bobby. He reached out and grasped the edge of the ship, much as Anderson had that first day. He was aware, too aware, that an expression of naked eagerness had spread over Bobby's face. It was the face of a someone who is waiting for a firecracker to go off. Several things happened almost simultaneously. The first was a sense of vibration settling into his hand, the sort of vibration one might feel when one lays a hand on a power pole carrying high-voltage wires. For a moment, it seemed to numb his flesh, as if the vibration was moving at an incredibly high speed. Then the feeling was gone. As it went, Gardner's head filled with music, but it was so loud it was more like a scream than music. It made what he had heard the night before sound like a whisper in comparison. It was like being inside a stereo speaker turned all the way up. He was opening his mouth to scream when it cut off all at once. Gardner knew the song, which had been popular when he was in grade school, and later he sang the snatch of lyrics he had heard, looking at his watch as he did so. The sequence seemed to have been a second or two of high-speed vibration, a burst of ear-splitting music which had lasted roughly 12 seconds, then the bloody nose. Except ear-splitting was wrong. It had been head-splitting. It had never come through his ears at all. It arrowed into his head from that damned piece of steel in his forehead. He saw Anderson go staggering backward, her hands thrown out in what seemed to be a warding-off gesture. Her look of eagerness became one of surprised fear, bewilderment, and pain. The last thing was that his headache was gone, utterly and completely gone. But his nose was not just bleeding, it was spouting. 3. Here, take it. Christ, guard, are you all right?
I'll be fine, Gardner said, his voice slightly muffled by her handkerchief.
He doubled it and settled it over his nose, pressing down firmly on the bridge. He tilted his head up, and the slimy taste of blood began to fill his throat.
I've had worse ones than this.
So he had, but not for a long time. They had moved back about 10 paces from the edge of the cut and seated themselves on a felled tree. Bobby was looking at him anxiously. Christ, guard, I didn't know anything like that was going to happen. You believe me, don't you?
Yes, Gardner said. He didn't know precisely what Bobby had been expecting, but not that. Did you hear the music?
I didn't exactly hear it, Anderson said. I got it secondhand from your head. It just about ruptured me.
Did it?
Yeah,
Bobby laughed a little shakily. When I'm around a lot of people, I turn them off.
You can do that?
He took the handkerchief off his nose. It was sopping with blood. Gardner could have twisted it between his fingers and wrung blood out of it in a gory little stream. But the flow was finally slowing down, thank God. He dropped the handkerchief and tore the tail off his shirt.
Yes, Anderson said. Well, not entirely. I can't turn the thoughts completely off, but I can dial them way down, so it's like, well, like a faint whisper at the bottom of my mind.
That's incredible. That's necessary, Anderson said grimly. If I couldn't, I don't think I'd ever leave this goddamn house again. I was in Augusta on Saturday, and I opened my mind up to see what it'd be like.
And you found out?
Yeah, I found out. It was like having a hurricane in your head. And the scary thing was how hard it was to get the door shut again.
This door, barrier, whatever. How do you put it up?
Anderson shook her head.
Can't explain. Any more than a guy who can wiggle his ears can explain how he does it.
She cleared her throat and looked down at her shoes for a moment. Muddy work boots, Gardner saw. They looked as if they hadn't been off her feet much in the last couple of weeks. Bobby grinned a little. The grin was embarrassed and painfully humorous at the same time, and in that moment she looked completely like the old Bobby, the one who had been his friend after nobody else wanted to be. It was Bobby's aw shucks look. Gardner had seen it the very first time he met her, when Bobby was a freshman English student, and Gardner, a freshman English instructor, banging apathetically away at a PhD thesis he probably knew even then he was never going to finish. Hungover and feeling bilious, Gardner had asked the class of new freshmen what the dative case was. No one offered an answer. Gardner had been about to take great pleasure in blowing them all out of the water when Anderson, Roberta, row 5, seat 3, raised her hand and took a shot at it. Her answer was diffident, but correct. Not surprisingly, she turned out to be the only one of them who'd had Latin in high school. The same aw shucks grin he was seeing now had been on Bobby's face then, and Gard felt a wave of affection sweep over him. Shit, Bobby had been through a tough time. But this was Bobby, no question about it.
I keep the barriers up most of the time anyway, she was saying. Otherwise it's like peeking in windows. You remember me telling you my mailman, Paulson, has got something going on the side? That isn't anything I want to know. Or if some poor slob is a klepto, or if some guy's a secret drinker. How's your nose?
Bleeding stopped. Gardner put down the bloody piece of shirt beside Bobby's handkerchief. So you keep the blocks up?
Yes.
For whatever reasons. Moral, ethical, or just to keep from going batshit with the noise, I keep them up.
With you, I let them down because I wasn't getting squat even when I tried.
I did try a couple of times, and if that makes you mad, I understand, but it was only curiosity because no one else is blank like that.
No one?
Nope. There must be some reason for it, something like having a really rare blood type. Maybe that even is it.
Sorry, I'm type O. Anderson laughed and got up.
You feel up to going back, Gard?
It's the plate in my head, Bobby.
He almost said it, and then for some reason decided not to.
The plate in my head is keeping you out.
I don't know how I know that, but I do.
Yeah, I'm fine, he said.
I could use a drink,
a cup of coffee, that's all.
You got it. Come on.
4.
While part of her had been reacting to Gard with the warmth and genuine good feeling she had always felt for him, even during the worst times, another part of her, a part that was not, strictly speaking, Bobby Anderson at all anymore, had stood coldly off to one side, watching everything carefully, assessing, questioning. And the first question was whether they She really wanted Gardner around at all. They had thought at first that all her problems would now be solved. Gard would join her on the dig, and she would no longer have to do this, well, this first part, all alone. He was right about one thing. Trying to do it all by herself had nearly killed her. But the change she had expected in him hadn't happened. Only that distressing nosebleed. He won't touch it again if it makes his nose bleed like that. He won't touch it, and he certainly won't go inside it. It may not come to that. After all, Peter never touched it. Peter didn't want to go near it, but his eye. And the age reversal. It's not the same. He's a man, not an old beagle dog. And face it, Bobby, except for the nosebleed and that blast of music, there was absolutely no change. No immediate change. Is it the steel plate in his skull? Maybe. But why should something like that make any difference? That cold part of Bobby didn't know. She only knew that it could have. The ship itself broadcast some kind of tremendous, almost animate force. Whatever had come in it was dead. She was sure she hadn't lied about that. But the ship itself was almost alive, broadcasting that enormous energy pattern through its metal skin. And she knew the broadcast area widened its umbrella a little with every inch of its surface she dug free. That energy had communicated itself to Gard. But then it had, what? Been converted somehow. First converted, and then blown off in a short, ferociously powerful radio transmission. So what do I do? She didn't know, but she knew it didn't matter. They would tell her. When the time came, they would tell her. In the meantime, he would bear watching. But if only she could read him. It would be so much simpler if she could fucking read him. A voice responded coldly. Get him drunk. Then you'll be able to read him. Then you'll be able to read him just fine. 5. They had come out on the Tomcat, which did not fly at all, but rolled along the ground just as it always had. But instead of the former racket and roar of its engine, it now rolled in a complete silence that was somehow ghastly. They came out of the woods and bumped along the edge of the garden. Anderson parked the Tomcat where it had been that morning. Gardner glanced up at the sky, which was beginning to cloud over again. He said, "You better put it in the shed, Bobby." "It'll be all right," she said shortly. She pocketed the key and started toward the house. Gardner glanced toward the shed, started after Bobby, then looked back. There was a big Krieg padlock on the shed door. Another new addition. The woods, you should pardon the pun, seemed to be full of them. What have you got in there? A time machine that runs on penlights? What's the new improved Bobby got in there? 6. When he came into the house, Bobby was rummaging in the fridge. She came up with a couple of beers. Were you serious about coffee, or do you want one of these? How about a Coke? Gardner asked. Flying saucers go better with Coke. That's my motto. He laughed rather wildly. Sure, Bobby said, then stopped in the act of returning the cans of beer and grabbing two cans of Coke.
I did, didn't I?
Huh? I took you out there and showed it to you. The ship, didn't I? Jesus, Gardner thought. Jesus Christ. For a moment, standing there with the bottles in her hands, she looked like someone with Alzheimer's disease. Yes, Gardner said, feeling his skin grow cold. You did. Good, Bobby said, relieved. I thought I did. Bobby, you all right? Sure, Anderson said, and then added offhandedly, as if it were a thing of little or no importance. It's just that I can't remember much from when we left the house until now. But I guess it doesn't really matter, does it? Here's your Coke, Gard. Let's drink to life on other worlds. What do you say? 7. So they drank to other worlds, And then Anderson asked him what they should do with the spaceship she had stumbled on in the woods behind her house. We're not going to do anything. You're going to do something.
I already am, Guard, she said gently.
Of course you are, he said a little testily. But I'm talking about some final disposition. I'll be happy to give you all the advice you want. Us drunken, broken-down poets are great at giving advice. But in the end, you're going to do something. Something a little more far-reaching than just digging it up. Because it's yours. It's down on your land, and it's yours.
Anderson looked shocked.
You don't really think that thing belongs to anyone, do you? Why, because Uncle Frank left me this place in his will? Because he had a clear title going back to part of a crown parcel that King George III swiped from the French after the French had swiped it from the Indians? Good Christ, Guard, that thing was 50 million years old when the forebears of the whole damned human race were squatting on their hunkers in caves and picking their noses.
I'm sure that's very true, Gardner said dryly, but it doesn't change the law.
And anyway, are you going to sit there and try to tell me you're not possessive of it?
Anderson looked both upset and thoughtful.
Possessive? No, I wouldn't say that. It's responsibility, I feel, not possessiveness.
Well, whatever. But since you asked my opinion, I'll give it to you.
Call Limestone Air Force Base. Tell whoever answers that you found an unidentified object down on your land that looks like an advanced flying machine of some sort. You might have some trouble at first, but you'll convince them. Then,
Bobby Anderson laughed.
She laughed long and hard and loud. It was genuine laughter, and there was nothing mean about it, but it made Gardner feel acutely uncomfortable all the same. She laughed until tears streamed down her face. He felt himself stiffening.
I'm sorry, she said, seeing his expression. It's just that I can't believe I'm hearing this from you, of all people. You know, it's just...
She snorted laughter again.
Well, it's a shock. Like having a Baptist preacher advise drinking as a cure for lust.
I don't understand what you mean.
Sure you do. I'm listening to the guy who got arrested at Seabrook with a gun in his pack. The guy who thinks the government won't really be happy until we all glow in the dark like radium watches. Tell me to just call up the Air Force so they can come down here and take charge of an interstellar spacecraft. It's your land.
Shit, Guard. My land is as vulnerable to the U.S. government's right of eminent domain as anybody else's. Eminent domain's what gets turnpikes built.
And sometimes nuclear reactors.
Bobby sat down again and looked at Gardner in level silence.
Think about what you're saying, she said softly. 3 days after I made a call like that, neither the land nor the ship would be mine anymore. 6 days after, they'd have barbed wire strung around the whole place and sentries posted every 50 feet. 6 weeks after, I think you'd probably find 80% of Haven's population bought out, kicked out, or simply lost. They could do it, Guard. You know they could. What it comes down to is this. You want me to pick up the phone and call the Dallas police.
Bobby, yes. That's what it boils down to. I found an alien spacecraft, and you want me to turn it over to the Dallas police. Do you think they're going to come down here and say, please come to Washington with us, Ms. Anderson. The Joint Chiefs of Staff are very anxious to hear your ideas on this matter. Not only because you own... well, used to own the land the thing is on, but because the Joint Chiefs always poll Western riders before they decide what they should do about such things. Also, the President wants you to pop around to the White House so he can get your thinking. In addition, he wants to tell you how much he liked Rimfire Christmas.
Anderson threw back her head, and this time the laughter she uttered was wild, hysterical, and quite creepy.
Gardner barely noticed. Did he really think they were going to come down here and be polite? With something as potentially enormous as this on the line? The answer was no. They would take the land. They would gag him and Bobby. But even that might not be enough to make them feel comfortable. Could be they'd wind up someplace like a weird cross between a Russian gulag and a posh Club Med resort. All the beads are free, and the only catch is you never get out. Or even that might not be enough. So, mourners, please omit flowers. Then, and only then, could the ship's new caretakers sleep easy at night. After all, it wasn't exactly an artifact, like an Etruscan vase or Minier balls dug out of the ground at the site of some long-ago Civil War battle, was it? The woman who had found it had subsequently managed to power her entire house on D-cells, and he was now ready to believe that even if the new gear on the Tomcat didn't work yet, it soon would. And what exactly would make it work? Microchips? Semiconductors? No. Bobby was the extra added ingredient, the new improved Bobby Anderson. Bobby. Or maybe it was anybody who got close to the thing. And a thing like that. Well, you couldn't let an ordinary private citizen hold on to it now, could you? Whatever else it is, he muttered. The goddamn thing must be one hell of a brain booster. It's turned you into a genius.
No. An idiot savant, Anderson said quietly.
What? Idiot savant? They've got maybe half a dozen of them down at Pineland. That's the state facility for the severely retarded. I was there for 2 summers on a work-study program while I was in college. There was a guy who could multiply 2 6-digit numbers in his head and give you a correct answer in less than 5 seconds. And he was just as apt to piss in his pants while he was doing it as not. There was a 12-year-old kid who was hydrocephalic. His head was as big as a prized pumpkin, but he could set perfectly justified type at the rate of 160 words a minute. Couldn't talk, couldn't read, couldn't think, but he could set type like a hurricane. Anderson pawed a cigarette out of the pack and lit it. Her eyes looked steadily at Gardner out of her thin, haggard face.
That's what I am, an idiot savant. That's all I am, and they'd know it.
Those things, customizing the typewriter, fixing the water heater, I only remember them in bits and pieces. When I'm doing them, everything seems as clear as a bell. But later, she looked pleadingly at Gardner.
Do you get it?
Gardner nodded.
It's coming from the ship, like radio transmissions from a broadcast tower.
But just because a radio can pick up transmissions and send them to a human ear, it's not talking. The government would be happy to take me, lock me up somewhere, and then cut me into little pieces to see if there had been any physical changes. Just as soon as my unfortunate accident gave them a reason to do an autopsy, that is.
Are you sure you're not reading my mind, Bobby?
No, but do you really think they'd scruple at wasting some people over a thing like this?
Gardner slowly shook his head.
So, taking your advice would amount to this, Anderson said. First, call the Dallas police. Then get taken into custody by the Dallas police. Then get killed by the Dallas police.
Guard looked at her, troubled, and then said,
All right, I cry uncle. But what's the alternative? You have to do something.
Christ, the thing is killing you.
What? You've lost 30 pounds. How's that for a start?
Anderson looked startled and uneasy.
No, guard, no way. 15, maybe, but I was getting love handles anyway, and
go weigh yourself, Gardner said. If you can get the needle over 95, even with your boots on, I'll eat the scale. Lose a few more pounds and you'll get sick. The state you're in, you could go into heartbeat arrhythmia and die in 2 days.
I needed to lose some weight, and I was too busy to eat. Was that what you were going to say?
Well, not exactly. When I saw you last night, you looked like a survivor of the Bataan Death March. You knew who I was, and that was all you knew.
You're still not tracking.
5 minutes after we got back in here from looking at your admittedly amazing find, you were asking me if you'd taken me to see it yet.
Bobby's eyes were still on the table, but he could see her expression. It was set and sullen.
He touched her gently. All I'm saying is that no matter how wonderful that thing in the woods is, it's done things to your body and mind that have been terrible for you.
Bobby drew away from him.
If you're saying I'm crazy, no, I'm not saying you're crazy, for God's sake. But you could get crazy if you don't slow down. Do you deny you've been having blackouts? You're cross-examining me, guard. And for a woman who was asking my advice 15 minutes ago, you're being a pretty fucking hostile witness. They glared at each other across the table for a moment. Anderson gave first. Blackouts isn't the right word. Don't try to equate what happens to you when you drink too much with what's been happening to me. They're not the same. I'm not going to argue semantics with you, Bobby. That's a sidetrack and you know it. The thing out there is dangerous. That's what seems important to me. Anderson looked up at him. Her face was unreadable. You think it is, she said, the words making neither a question nor a declarative sentence. They came out perfectly flat and inflectionless. You haven't just been getting or receiving ideas, Gardner said. You've been driven. Driven. Anderson's expression did not change. Gardner rubbed at his forehead. Driven, yes, driven the way a bad, stupid man will drive a horse until it drops dead in the traces, then stand over it and whip the carcass because the damn nag had the nerve to die. A man like that is dangerous to horses, and whatever there is in that ship, I think it's dangerous to Bobby Anderson. If I hadn't shown up, what? If you hadn't shown up, what? I think you'd still be at it right now, working day and night, not eating. And that by this coming weekend you'd have been dead. I think not, Bobby said coolly. But just for the sake of argument, let's say you're right. I'm on track again now. You're not on track again, and you're not all right. That mulish look was back on her face. That look which said Guard was talking trash, Bobby would just as soon not hear. Look, Gardner said, I'm with you on at least one thing all the way. This is the biggest, most important, utterly mind-blowing thing that's ever happened. When it comes out, the headlines in the New York Times are going to make it look like the National Enquirer. People are going to change their fucking religions over this. Do you know it? Yes. This isn't a powder keg. It's an A-bomb. Do you know that? Yes, Anderson said again. Then get that pissed-off look off your face. If we're going to talk about it, let's fucking talk about it. Anderson sighed. Yeah, okay. Sorry. I admit I was wrong about calling the Air Force. They spoke together, then laughed together, and that was good. Still smiling, Guard said, Something has to be done. I'll buy that, Anderson said. But, Bobby, Jesus, I flunked chemistry and barely got through funny book physics. I don't know exactly, but I do know it's got to be, well, damped out or something. We need some experts. That's right, Gardner said, seizing on it. Experts. Guard, all the experts work for the Dallas police. Gardner threw his hands up in disgust. Now that you're here, I'll be all right. I know it. It's more likely to go the other way. Next thing, I'll start having blackouts. Anderson said, I think the risk might be worth it. You've decided already, haven't you? I've decided what I want to do, yeah. What I want to do is keep quiet about it and finish the dig. Digging it all the way out shouldn't even be necessary. I think that once we, I hope, can free it to a depth of another 40 or 50 feet, we could come to a hatchway. If we can get inside. Bobby's eyes gleamed, and Gardner felt an answering excitement rise in his own chest at the thought. All the doubts in the world could not hold back that excitement. If we can get inside, Gardner repeated. If we can get inside, we can get at the controls, and if we can do that, I'm going to fly that fucker right out of the ground. You think you can do that? I know I can. And then? Then, I don't know, Bobby said, shrugging. It was the best, most efficient lie she had told so far. But Gardner thought it was a lie. The next thing will happen. That's all I know. But you say it's my decision to make.
Yes, I do.
As far as the outside world goes, all I can do is continue to not tell. If you decide you will, well, what could I do to stop you? Shoot you with Uncle Frank's shotgun? I couldn't. Maybe a character in one of my books could, but I couldn't. This, unfortunately, is real life, where there are no real answers. I guess in real life, I'd just stand here watching you go.
But whoever you called, Guard, scientists from the university up in Orono, biologists from Jennings Labs, physicists from MIT, whoever you called, it would turn out you'd actually call the Dallas police. You'd have people coming in here with trucks full of barbed wire and men with guns.
She smiled a little. At least I wouldn't have to go to that police state Club Med alone.
No, no. You're in it now, too. When they flew me out there, you'd be right beside me in the next seat.
The wan smile broadened. There still wasn't much humor in it.
Welcome to the monkey house, my friend. Aren't you glad you came?
Charmed, Gardner said. And suddenly they were both laughing. 8. When the laughter passed, Gardner found that the atmosphere in Bobby's kitchen had eased considerably. Anderson asked, "What do you think would happen to the ship if the Dallas police got hold of it?"
"Have you ever heard of Hangar 18?" Gard asked.
"No."
"According to the stories, Hangar 18's supposed to be part of an Air Force base outside of Dayton, or Dearborn, or somewhere, anywhere USA. It's where they're supposed to have the bodies of about 5 little men with fishy faces and gills on their necks. Saucerians. It's just one of those stories you hear, like how somebody found a rat head in his fast food burger, or how there are alligators in the New York sewers. Only now I sort of wonder if it is a fairy tale. But I think that would be the end."
"Can I tell you one of those modern fairy tales, Guard?"
"Lay it on me."
"Have you ever heard the one," she asked, "about the guy who invented a pill to take the place of gasoline?"
9. The sun was going down in a bright blaze of reds and yellows and purples. Gardner sat on a big stump in Bobby Anderson's backyard watching it go. They had talked most of the afternoon, sometimes discussing, sometimes reasoning, sometimes arguing. Bobby had ended the palaver by declaring herself ravenous again. She made a huge pot of spaghetti and broiled thick pork chops. Gardner had followed her out into the kitchen, wanting to reopen the discussion. Thoughts were rolling around in his mind like balls on a pool table. Anderson wouldn't allow it. She offered Gardner a drink, which Gardner, after a long, thoughtful pause, took. The whiskey went down good, and felt good. But he seemed to have no need for a second. Well, no great need. Now, sitting here full of food and drink and looking at the sky, he supposed Bobby had been right. They'd done all the constructive talking there was to do. It was decision time. Bobby had eaten a tremendous supper. "You're going to puke, Bobby," Gardner said. He was serious, but still couldn't help laughing.
"Nope," Bobby said placidly. "Never felt better." She burped. "In Portugal, that's a compliment to the cook."
And after a good lay, Guard lifted one leg and broke wind. Bobby laughed gustily. They did the dishes.
"Haven't invented anything to do this yet, Bobby?"
"It'll come. Give me time."
And then they went into the small, drab living room, which hadn't changed much since the time of Bobby's uncle, to watch the evening news. None of it was very good. The Middle East was smoldering again, with Israel flying airstrikes against Syrian ground forces in Lebanon and hitting a school by accident. Gardner winced at the pictures of burned, screaming children. The Russians driving against the mountain strongholds of the Afghan rebels, a coup in South America. In Washington, the NRC had issued a list of 90 nuclear facilities in 37 states with safety problems, ranging from moderate to serious.
Moderate to serious. Great, Gardner thought, feeling the old impotent rage stir and twist, biting into him like acid. If we lose Topeka, that's moderate.
If we lose New York, that's serious.
He became aware that Bobby was looking at him a little sadly.
The beat goes on, right? She said.
Right.
When the news was over, Anderson told Gardner she was going to bed.
At 7:30?
I'm still bushed. And she looked at.
Okay, I'll sack out myself pretty soon. I'm tired, too. It's been a crazy couple of days, but I'm not completely sure I'd sleep the way this stuff is whizzing around in my head.
You want a Valium?
He smiled. I saw they were still there. I'll pass. You were the one who could have used a trank or two last couple of weeks.
The state of Maine's price for going along with Nora's decision not to press charges was that Gardner should go into a counseling program. The program had lasted 6 months. The Valium was apparently going to go on forever. Gardner hadn't actually taken any in almost 3 years, but every now and then, usually when he was going traveling, he filled the prescription. Otherwise, some computer might burp up his name, and a psychologist, picking up a few extra bucks courtesy of the state of Maine, might drop by to make sure his head was staying shrunk to a suitable size. After she was in bed, Gardner had turned off the TV and sat a while in Bobby's rocker, reading the Buffalo Soldiers. In a short time, he heard her snoring away. Gardner supposed Bobby's snores would also be part of a conspiracy to keep him awake, but he didn't really mind. Bobby had always snored, the price of a deviated septum, and that had always annoyed Gardner. But he had discovered last night that some things were worse. The ghastly silence in which she had slept on the couch, for instance. That was much worse. Gardner had poked his head in for a moment and had seen Bobby in a much more typical Bobby Anderson sleeping posture, naked except pajama bottoms, small breasts bare, blankets kicked into disarray between her legs, one hand curled under her cheek, the other by her face, her thumb almost in her mouth. Bobby was okay. So Gardner had come out here to make his decision. Bobby's patch of garden was going great guns. The corn was taller than any Gardner had seen on his way north from Arcadia Beach, and her tomatoes were going to be blue ribbon winners. Some of them would have come to the chest of a man walking down the row. In the middle of it all was a cluster of giant sunflowers, ominous as triffids, nodding in the slight breeze. When Bobby asked him earlier if he'd ever heard of the so-called gasoline pill, Gardner had smiled and nodded. More 20th century fairy tales, all right. She'd then asked him if he believed it. Gardner, still smiling, said no. Bobby reminded him about Hangar 18. Are you saying you do believe there's such a pill? Or was? Something you'd just drop into your gas tank and run on all day?
No, Bobby said quietly. Nothing I've ever read suggests the possibility of such a pill.
She leaned forward, forearms on her thighs.
But I'll tell you what I do believe. If there was, it wouldn't be on the market. Some big cartel, or maybe the government itself, would buy it, or steal it.
Yeah, Gard said. He had thought more than once about the crazy ironies inherent in every status quo. Open the U.S. borders and put all those customs people out of work? Legalize dope and destroy the DEA? Might as well try to shoot the man in the moon with a BB gun.
Gard burst out laughing.
Bobby looked at him, puzzled but also smiling a little.
So, share.
I was just thinking that if there was a pill like that, the Dallas police would shoot the guy who invented it and then put it next to the green guys in Hangar 18. Not to mention his whole family, Bobby agreed.
Gard didn't laugh this time. This time it didn't seem quite so hilarious.
In that light, Anderson had said, look at what I've done here. I'm not even a good handyman, let alone anyone's scientist. And so the force that worked through me produced a bunch of stuff that looks more like stuff from boys' life plans than anything else, built by a fairly incompetent boy at that.
They work, Gardner replied.
Yes, Anderson had agreed, they did. She even had a vague idea of how they worked, on a principle which could be called collapsing molecule fusion. It was non-atomic, totally clean. The telepathic typewriter, she said, depended on collapsing molecule fusion for juice, but the actual principle of that was one much different, and she didn't understand it. There was a power pack inside that had begun life as a fuzz buster, but beyond that, she was blank. You get a bunch of scientists in here from the NSA or the shop, and they probably have this stuff down pat in 6 hours, Anderson said. They'd go around looking like somebody just kicked them in the balls, asking each other how the hell they could have missed such elementary concepts for so long. And do you know what would happen next? Gardner thought about it hard, his head down, one hand gripping the can of beer Bobby had given him, the other gripping his forehead. And suddenly he was back at that terrible party, listening to Ted the Power Man defend the Iroquois plant, which even now was loading hot rods. If we gave these nuke freaks what they wanted, they'd turn around a month or so later and start whining about not being able to use their blow dryers, or found out their Cuisinarts weren't going to work when they wanted to mix up a bunch of macrobiotic food. He saw himself leading Ted the Power Man over to Arberg's buffet. He saw this as clearly as if it had happened. Shit, as if it was happening right then. On the table, between the chips and the bowl of raw veggies, was one of Bobby's contraptions. The batteries were hooked up to a circuit board that was in turn hooked up to an ordinary wall switch, the sort available in any hardware store for a buck or so. Gardner saw himself turn this switch, and suddenly everything on the table, chips, raw veggies, the Lazy Susan with its 5 different kinds of dip, the remains of cold cuts and the carcass of the chicken, the ashtrays, the drinks, rose 6 inches into the air and then simply held there, their shadows pooling decorously beneath them on the linen. Ted the Power Man looked at this for a moment, mildly annoyed. Then he swept the contraption off the table. The wires snapped, batteries rolled hither and yon. Everything fell back to the table with a crash, glasses spilling, ashtrays overturning and scattering butts. Ted took off his sport coat and covered the remains of the gadget, the way you might cover the corpse of an animal hit and killed in the road. That done, he turned back to his small captive audience and resumed speaking. These people think they can go on having their cake and eating it, too, forever. These people assume that there is always going to be a fallback position. They are wrong. There is no fallback position. It's simple. Nukes or nothing. Gardner heard himself screaming in a rage that was, for a change, totally sober. What about the thing you just broke? What about that? Ted bent and picked up his sport coat as gracefully as a magician waving his cape before a bedazzled audience. The floor beneath was bare, except for a few potato chips. No sign of the gadget. No sign at all. What about what thing? Ted the Power Man asked, looking straight at Gardner with an expression of sympathy into which a liberal helping of contempt had been mixed. He turned to his audience. Does anybody here see anything? No, they were answering in unison, like children reciting. Arberg, Patricia McCardle, all the rest, even the young bartender and Ron Cummings were reciting it. No, we don't see anything. We don't see anything at all, Ted. Not a thing. You're right, Ted. It's the nukes or nothing. Ted was smiling. Next thing you know, he'll be telling us that old wheeze about the itty-bitty pill you can put in your gas tank and run your car on all day. Ted the Power Man began to laugh. All the others joined in. All of them were laughing at him. Gardner raised his head and turned agonized eyes on Bobby Anderson. You'd think they'd, what, classify all this? Don't you? And after a moment, in a very gentle voice, Anderson prompted, Guard? Yes, Gardner said after a long time, and for a moment he was very close to bursting into tears. Yeah, sure. Sure they would. 10. Now he sat on a stump in Bobby's backyard without the slightest idea there was a loaded shotgun pointed at the back of his head. He sat thinking of his mental replay of the party. It was so horrifying and so utterly obvious that he supposed he could be forgiven the time it had taken him to see it and grasp it. The ship and the Earth could not be dealt with just on the basis of Bobby's welfare or Haven's welfare. Regardless of what it was or what it was doing to Bobby or anyone else in the immediate area, the ultimate disposition of the ship and the Earth would have to be made on the basis of the world's welfare. Gardner had served on dozens of committees whose goals ranged from the possible to the wildly crazed. He had marched, had given more than he could afford to help pay for newspaper ads in two unsuccessful campaigns to close Maine Yankee by referendum. As a college student, he had marched against the U.S. involvement in Vietnam. He belonged to Greenpeace. He supported NARAL. In half a dozen muddled ways, he had tried to deal with the world's welfare. But his efforts, although growing out of individual thought, had always been expressed as part of a group. Now, up to you, guard, old guard. Just you. He sighed. It was like a sob. Ring those funky changes, white boy. Sure. But first ask yourself, who wants the world to change? The unfed, the unwell, the unhomed, right? The parents of those kids in Africa with the big bellies and the dying eyes. The blacks in South Africa. The PLO. Does Ted the Power Man want a big helping of funky changes? Bite your tongue. Not Ted, not the Russian Politburo, not the Knesset, not the President of the United States, not the Seven Sisters, not Xerox, not Barry Manilow. Oh no, not the big boys, not the ones with the real power, the ones who drove the status quo machine. Their motto was, get the funk out of my face. There was a time when he would not have hesitated for a moment, and that time was not so long past. Bobby wouldn't have needed any arguments. Guard himself would have been the guy flogging the horse until its heart burst. Only he would have been right there in harness too, pulling alongside. Here, at last, was a source of clean power, so abundant and easy to produce, it might as well be free. Within 6 months, every nuclear reactor in the United States could be brought to a cold stop. Within a year, every reactor in the world. Cheap power, cheap transport, travel to other planets, even other star systems seemed possible. After all, Bobby's ship had not gotten to Haven, Maine on the good ship Lollipop. It was, in fact, give us a drum roll, please, Maestro, the answer to everything. Are there weapons on board that ship, do you think? He had started to ask Bobby that, and something had stopped his mouth. Weapons? Maybe. And if Bobby could receive enough of that residual force to create a telepathic typewriter, could she also create something that would look like a Flash Gordon stun gun, but which might actually work? Or a disintegrator? A tractor beam? Something which would, instead of just going broom or whacka whacka whacka, would actually turn people into piles of smoldering ash? Possibly. And if not, wouldn't some of Bobby's hypothetical scientists adapt things like the water heater gadget or the customized Tomcat motor to something that would put a radical hurt on people? Sure. After all, long before toasters and hair dryers and baseboard heaters were ever thought of, the state of New York was using electricity to fry murderers at Sing Sing. What scared Gardner was that the idea of weapons held a certain attractiveness. Part of it, he supposed, was just self-interest. If the order came down to put a sport coat over the mess, then surely he and Bobby would be part of what was to be covered. But beyond that were other possibilities. One of them, wild but not unattractive, was the idea that he and Bobby might be able to kick a lot of asses that deserved kicking. The idea of sending happy time folks like the Ayatollah into the Phantom Zone was so delightful that it almost made Gardner chuckle. Why wait for the Israelis and the Arabs to sort out their problems? And terrorists of all stripes. Goodbye, fellas. Catch you on the flip-flop. Wonderful, Guard. I love it. We'll put it on network TV. It'll be better than Miami Vice. Instead of two fearless drug busters, we got Guard and Bobby cruising the planet in their flying saucer. Give me the phone, someone. I gotta call CBS. You're not funny, Gardner thought. Who's laughing? Isn't that what you're talking about?
You and Bobby playing the Lone Ranger and Tonto?
So what if it is? How long does it take before that option starts looking good?
How many suitcase bombs? How many women shot in embassy toilets? How many dead kids? How long do we let it all go on?
Love it, Guard.
Okay, everyone on planet Earth, sing along with Guard and Bobby. Just follow the bouncing ball. The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. You're disgusting. And you're starting to sound downright dangerous. You remember how scared you were when that state trooper found the pistol in your pack? How scared you were because you didn't even remember putting it in there? This is it all over again. The only difference is that you're now talking about a bigger caliber. Dear Christ, are you ever? As a younger man, these questions never would have occurred to him. And if they had, he would simply have brushed them aside. Apparently, Bobby already had. She was, after all, the one who had mentioned the man on horseback.
What do you mean, a man on horseback?
I mean us, Guard. But I think I mostly mean you. Bobby, when I was 25, I burned all the time. When I was 30, I burned some of the time. But the oxygen in here must be getting thin because now I only burn when I'm drunk. I'm scared to climb up on that horse, Bobby. If history ever taught me anything, it taught me that horses like to bolt.
He shifted on the stump again, and the shotgun followed him.
Anderson sat in the kitchen on a stool, the barrels swiveling a bit on the windowsill with every move Gardner made. She was getting very little of his thoughts. It was frustrating, maddening. But she was getting enough to know that Gardner was approaching a decision. And when he made it, Anderson thought she would know what it was. If it was the wrong one, she was going to blow off the back of his head and bury the body in the soft soil at the foot of the garden. She would hate to do that, but if she had to, she would. Anderson waited calmly for the moment, her mind tuned to the faint run of Gardner's thoughts, making the tenuous connection. It would not be long now.
11. What really scares you is the chance to deal from a position of strength for the first time in your miserable, confused life.
He sat up straighter, an expression of dismay on his face.
It wasn't true, was it?
Surely it wasn't.
Oh, but Guard, it is. You even root for baseball teams that are cataclysmic underdogs. That way you never have to worry about being depressed if one of them blows it in the World Series. It's the same with the candidates and the causes you support, isn't it? Because if your politics never get a chance to be tried out, you never have to worry about finding out that the new boss is the same as the old boss, do you?
I'm not scared, not of that.
The fuck you're not. A man on horseback? You? Man, that's a laugh. You'd have a heart attack if someone asked you to be a man on a tricycle. Your own personal life has been nothing but a constant effort to destroy every power base you have. Take marriage. Nora was tough. You finally had to shoot her to get rid of her. But when the chips were down, you didn't stick at it, did you? You're a man who manages to rise to every occasion, I'll give you that. You got yourself fired from your teaching job, thus eliminating another power base. You've spent 12 years pouring enough booze onto the little spark of talent God gave you to put it out. Now this. You better run, Guard.
That's not fair. Honest to God, it's not.
No? Isn't there enough truth in it to make a comeuppance?
Maybe. Maybe not.
Either way, he discovered that the decision had already been made. He would stick with Bobby, at least for a while. Do it her way. Bobby's blithe assurance that everything was just ducky didn't jive very well with her exhaustion and weight loss. What the ship in the Earth could do to Bobby, it would probably do to him. What had happened, or failed to happen, today proved nothing. He would not have expected all the changes to come at once, yet the ship, and whatever force emanated from it, had a great capacity to do good. That was the main thing. And, well, fuck the Tommyknocker man. Gardner got up and walked toward the house. The sun had gone down, and the twilight was turning ashy. His back was stiff. He stretched, standing on his toes, and grimaced as his spine crackled. He looked past the dark, silent shape of the tomcat to the shed door with its new padlock. He thought of going to it, trying to look through one of the dirt-grimed windows, and decided not to. Perhaps he was afraid a white face would pop up inside the dark window, its grin showing a mouthful of filed cannibal teeth in a deadly ring. "Hello, guard. You want to meet some genuine Tommyknockers? Come on in. There's lots of us in here." Gardner shivered. He could almost hear thin, evil fingers scrabbling on the panes. Too much had happened today and yesterday. His imagination had gotten out. Tonight it would walk and talk. He didn't know if he should hope for sleep or for it to stay away. 12. Once he was back inside, his uneasiness began to fade. With it went some of his craving for drink. He took off his shirt and then peered into Anderson's room. Bobby lay just as she had lain before, blankets caught between her dreadfully thin legs, one hand thrown out, snoring. "Hasn't even moved. Christ, she must be tired." He took a long shower, turning the water up as hot as he dared. With Bobby Anderson's new water heater, that meant barely jogging the knob 5 degrees west of dead cold. When his skin began to turn red, he stepped out into a bathroom as steamy as London in the grip of a late Victorian-era fog. He toweled, brushed his teeth with a finger. "Got to do something about getting some supplies here," he thought, and went to bed. Drifting off, he found himself thinking again about the last thing Bobby had said during their discussion. She believed the ship in the earth had begun to affect the townspeople. When he asked for specifics, she grew vague, then changed the subject. Gardner supposed anything was possible in this crazy business. Although the old Frank Garrick place was in the boonies, it was almost exactly in the geographic center of the township itself. There was a Haven Village, but that was 5 miles further north. "You make it sound as if it was throwing off poison gas," he had said, hoping he didn't sound as uneasy as he felt. "Paraquat from space. They came from Agent Orange." "Poison gas," Bobby repeated. She had gone off by herself again. Her face, so thin now, was closed and distant. "No, not poison gas. Call it fumes if you want to call it anything. But it's more than just the vibration when a person touches it." Gardner said nothing, not wanting to break her mood.
"Fumes? Not that either. But like fumes. If EPA came in here with sniffers, I don't think they'd find any pollutants at all. If there's any actual physical residue in the air, it's nothing but the tiniest trace."
"Do you think that's possible, Bobby?" Gardner asked quietly.
"Yes. I'm not telling you I know that's what's happening, because I don't. I have no inside information. But I think that a very thin layer of the ship's hull, and I mean thin, maybe no more than a single molecule or two in depth, could be oxidizing as I uncover it and the air hits it. That means I'd get the first, heaviest dose, and then it would go with the wind like fallout. The people in town would get most of it, but most would really mean damn little in this case." Bobby shifted in her rocker and reached down with her right hand. It was a gesture Gardner had seen her make many times before, and his heart went out to his friend when he saw the look of sorrow cross Bobby's face. Bobby put her hand back into her lap.
"But I'm not sure that's what's going on at all, you know. There's a novel by a man named Peter Straub called Floating Dragon. Have you read it?"
Gardner had shaken his head.
"Well, it postulates something similar to your Agent Orange from space, or Paraquat of the Gods, or whatever you called it."
Gardner smiled.
"In the story, an experimental chemical is sucked out into the atmosphere and falls on a piece of suburban Connecticut. This stuff really is poison, a kind of insanity gas. People get in fights for no reason. Some fellow decides to paint his whole house, including the windows, bright pink. A woman jogs until she drops dead of a massive coronary, and so on. There's another novel. This one is called Brainwave, and it was written by...
Anderson wrinkled her brow, thinking. Her hand stole down to the right of the rocker again, then came back.
Same name as mine. Anderson. Paul Anderson. In that one, the Earth passes through the tail of a comet, and some of the fallout makes animals smarter. The book starts with a rabbit literally reasoning its way out of a trap.
Smarter, Gardner echoed.
Yes. If you had an IQ of 120 before the Earth went through the comet, you'd end up with an IQ of 180. Get it?
Well-rounded intelligence?
Yes.
But the term you used before was idiot savant. That's the exact opposite of well-rounded intelligence, isn't it? It's a kind of bump.
Anderson waved this aside. Doesn't matter, she said.
Now, lying here in bed, drifting off to sleep, Gardner wondered.
13. That night, he had a dream. It was simple enough. He was standing in darkness outside of the shed between the farmhouse and the garden. To his left, the tomcat was a dark shape. He was thinking exactly what he had been thinking tonight, that he would go over and look in one of the windows. And what would he see? Why, the Tommyknockers, of course. But he wasn't afraid. Instead of fear, he felt delighted, relieved, joy. Because the Tommyknockers weren't monsters or cannibals, they were like the elves in that story about the good shoemaker. He would look in through the dirty shed window like a delighted child looking out of a bedroom window in an illustration from The Night Before Christmas. And what was Santa Claus, that right jolly old elf, but a big old Tommyknocker in a red suit? And he would see them, laughing and chattering as they sat at a long table, cobbling together power generators and levitating skateboards and televisions which showed mind movies instead of regular ones. He drifted toward the shed, and suddenly it was lighted by the same glare he had seen coming out of Bobby's modified typewriter. It was as if the shed had turned into some weird jack-o'-lantern, only this light was not a warm yellow, but an awful, rotten green. It spilled out between the boards. It spilled rays through knotholes and tattooed evil cat's eyes on the ground. It filled the windows. And now he was afraid, because no friendly little aliens from space made that light. If cancer had a color, it would be the one that spilled from every chink and crack and knothole and window of Bobby Anderson's shed. But he drew closer, because in dreams you can't always help yourself. He drew closer, no longer wanting to see, no more than a kid would want to look out his bedroom window on Christmas Eve and see Santa Claus striding along the snow-covered slope of roof across the way with a severed head in each gloved hand, the blood from the ragged necks steaming in the cold.
Please, no. Please, no.
But he drew closer, and as he entered that haze of green, rock music spilled into his head in a paralyzing, mind-splitting flood. It was George Thorogood in The Destroyers, and he knew that when George started to play that slide guitar, his skull would vibrate for a moment with killing harmonics, and then simply explode like the water glasses in the house he had once told Bobby about. None of it mattered. The fear mattered, that was all. The fear of the Tommyknockers in Bobby's shed. He sensed them, could almost smell them, a rich electric smell like ozone and blood. And the weird liquid sloshing sounds. He could hear those even over the music in his head. It sounded like an old-fashioned washing machine, except that sound wasn't water. And that sound was wrong, wrong, wrong. As he stood on his tiptoes to look into the shed, his face as green as the face of a corpse pulled out of quicksand, George Thorogood started to play that slide blues guitar, and Gardner began screaming with pain. And that was when his head exploded, and he woke sitting bolt upright in the old double bed in the guest room, his chest covered with sweat, his hands trembling. He lay down again, thinking,
God, if you're going to have nightmares about it, take a look in tomorrow. Get your mind easy.
He had expected nightmares in the wake of his decision. He lay back down again, thinking that this was only the first. But there were no more dreams. Bad night. The next day, he joined Bobby on the dig.